And when you think of escape, there is no chance. The beat holds you tight when we're on the mic, cause I'm MC Reggie Ranch and I'm out of sight. The beat stroll, am I mellow? What it look like when you're on the mic? Tell a sucker MC, don't bite.
Well, I'm the one that kind and I feel real fine. You see, I rock young Reggie's most any time. And I may sound conceited, but I tell you what, I got a bunch of girls that's trying to bust my nut. I want all of y'all to understand what Barry B. Stroll is, the maiden's land. I want all of y'all to shout it out and what Barry B. Stroll is all about. Because A is the apple, J is the jack. If you don't get that, you must be whack. With the needle to the groove to make you move, you put the bass in the face to rock your face. With the highs in your eyes, I make your nature rise. But come on, y'all, let's do it.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KVU is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KVU are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KVU has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KVU today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, We Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032.
Support KVU,
where music makes the movement.
The time is 6:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey,
hi.
Rachel.
Hey there.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the phone is Reese Chenault.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
Hi, Reese. Reese, I wanted to point out to our listeners that you aren't an educator. Can you tell us about your background and how you got involved with labor unions?
Sure. I was an organizer on my college campus around the Iraq War, and I was a historically black college. And I was doing some actions that were fairly successful, and it was becoming more and more difficult for me to be a student because I was getting into a lot of trouble. And my advisors sat me down and said, you know, you don't seem like you want to learn the things that you probably set out to learn when you first started. It seems like you're interested in something else. And maybe this summer, you should go and be in the union summer program. We just got a form and you should fill it out and talk to someone. And at the time, I didn't know this but it wasn't the biggest idea to go recruiting on historically black college campuses, particularly the one that I was going to.
Mm-hmm.
A nice lady named Sarah McKenzie, who went on to work for a lot of places, including the Solidarity Center, oddly enough, through the AFL-CIO, was working with Union Summer at the time and saw that my application, our addresses were literally maybe half a mile from each other. And so she called me and said, you know, hey, I'm from Gaithersburg too. And I was shocked to see your address in here, and it just closed. We've got one slot left. Are you interested? And I went to Mississippi with Union Summer, and I didn't look back. And I've been organizing with labor unions in all different types of ways for almost 15 years now.
Oh, thank you. And can you tell us a little bit about the U.S. Labor Against the War?
Sure. So the organization was actually around, was forming around the same time that I was becoming interested in both labor organizing and anti-war organizing. And so I like to explain it to folks outside of the labor movement as a group that works at the intersection of demilitarization and economic justice. And so those two issue areas together have a lot of linkages that often get left unexplored. And so part of the challenge for U.S. Labor Against the War is trying to figure out how to work within that intersection and pull what are often disparate parts of two different movements mm-hmm. together to actually work on the issues. The folks that founded this organization really came to it with the idea of let's move the labor movement farther to the left on foreign policy, and let's do it through relationships that we, the two founders, Gene Bruskin and Bob Mellencamp, already held. They already had relationships with lots of union presidents because that was their community. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of labor leaders got together at that time. Now, fast forward to 2018, we live in a really different environment. So much has changed since the Iraq War that a lot of the work that U.S. Labor Against the War now is very different than the work that we were engaged in at the start. And so we really try to push what a lot of our allies and comrades call people-powered diplomacy. With the idea that folks who, you know, I like to say work for a living, have just as much to say about this stuff as the politicians do. They have just as much to say about it as our sometimes buddies, but, you know, policy wonks do. The difference is that it's an often ignored voice. And so our challenge and our strategy is to move that. To move that voice to the front and make sure that working people are heard on this issue as well.
So, I mean, you touched on what was our next question. I guess I wonder the ways that the current sort of anti-war and maybe anti-militarization movement intersects with unionism today. I mean, you talked a little that it's a very different landscape than the start of the Iraq War, and with the kind of demise of the strength of unionism in general in this country. What do you think the unique challenges are right now?
I tend to think of it as the intersection. Provides for a lot of similarities. Trade unionism in the United States has seen, you know, significant decline, as you pointed out. But honestly, so has anti-war activism in the United States. And so I think part of the work that we do at that intersection is really about galvanizing these forces and looking at a different way of approaching them. You know, I was hired as kind of a shift in thinking about how to get at these problems. And one of the things that I really have worked hard to push forward in U.S. labor against the war is the idea that a lot of the trade union basics and the things that we really love about the labor movement are things that actually the anti-war movement desperately needs. One of those things is getting in touch with and moving a base and actually thinking about how do we present issues that touch folks in a way that moves them to take action? How do we instill the basics of organizing in people and get them to use those organizing tactics that we're actually very, very familiar with in the labor movement to move on issues of anti-war work? And then there's also, you know, the political side of it as well. The reality is that a lot of our brothers and sisters are kind of trapped in the military-industrial complex, and we need to actually be able to do the work to get them out of it. And we have to get them out of it with solidarity, but also with consent. You know, folks don't want to just lose their job and be told to find another one. We have to actually do the work to figure out where we can connect people.
Thank you,
Reese. We're talking with you in large part because this is Veterans Day, so we thought that a theme related to that for our show today would be interesting. It's great to have you on. Question for you: is part of the idea that if we focus on worker solidarity around the world, that we would naturally be against using military force in those countries? I mean, if we're focused on relationships with our fellow workers around the world, we don't want harm to come to them.
Yeah, I think I think part of this is about finding ways to get workers to understand that what we do here has an effect on people elsewhere, but also to get folks to understand that workers in other countries have dreams, have their own ideas about how they want their countries to be governed, and also have ideas about how they want their economies to be run. I think it's been interesting with some of the recent solidarity work that we've done with folks in Korea. You know, we had all kinds of highfalutin ideas about big meetings and things like that that I thought, you know, were going to, you know, blow people's hair back. But oddly, the stuff that really moved people was hanging out with farmers and eating the fruit that they'd grown. And one of the things that folks took away and really commented on was, I mean, for one thing, they ate some strawberries that apparently changed people's lives.
It was literally the fruits of their labor.
Indeed. But also folks said, you know, I didn't realize that so much of what we think of as a person or a country or a circumstance that we've never been faced with or introduced to has to do with the way our countries portray those other places. And that when we tear down those walls and we actually meet those people face to face, we find that with the mystery stripped away, there just isn't much to what we've been presented with as the face of people in South Korea or in North Korea, the face of people in Iran or in Yemen. Those folks often, even with language barriers, are able to communicate so much once people are close to each other. So I think that's right on point. You know, I think that focusing on worker solidarity does change people's minds about where our money should be going, but also where our military should be.
Yeah. Would you say that you're a proponent of internationalism?
I definitely would say that I am. I think that part of the challenge of being in an organization as large as ours is that not everybody's there yet. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also a testament to what kind of organization U.S. law has been and is trying to be. You know, I tell people all the time who aren't that familiar with the labor movement, when they talk about decisions that labor union folks make in terms of voting or everything else, that labor is one of the only places I've been in organizing spaces in where the entry point for folks isn't some magical political education litmus test. The door is just open. And if you're working and you've got the union card, then everybody wants to talk about where we can do some political education, where you can get involved. And from there, folks grow, right? So I think for me, like, while I might be excited about talking about internationalism, it might be a far-flung step for a lot of folks in the organization. And for me, that's okay. I think that's actually an opportunity, a chance for us to really grow together and also find out what workers want so that we can be better at doing our jobs.
Gotcha. So how should labor unions be involved in foreign policy decisions?
I think that's twofold. I think for one, labor unions as organizations should be speaking in concert to legislators, not just about trade deals, but where we are selling arms, and we should be telling people to stop doing it. You know, U.S. Labor Against the War has been has promoted quite a few resolutions on all kinds of things through the AFL-CIO at different conventions and large unions and small unions. But overall, we just feel that labor should recognize that the military-industrial complex requires us to militarize our foreign policy because it's profitable. Yes. And as soon as we attack that profit margin, we get at the root of a lot of things that folks really didn't think we would get at the root of, like racism and all kinds of other kinds of xenophobia.
Gotcha. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio.
And I'd like to follow up on that, Reese. Can you talk about your involvement in unions that represent workers in the military-industrial complex here in the United States?
Sure. We spent about a year just listening to folks who make ships up in Bath, Maine, working with folks like Bruce Gagnon about thinking about how do we talk to our brothers and sisters in these organizations. I often tell folks, again, who really aren't in the labor movement, that a lot of unions, a lot of central labor councils, for example, point to the fact that they are often in spaces with those unions, but don't really have the ability to talk to them about things outside of wages and benefits and the normal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as social justice movement unionism has taken more of a hold, those trades, the ones like the machinists, for example, often feel left out of the loop.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of machinists are really progressive and do a lot of great work, but it's not the same all over the country. I live in Louisville, Kentucky, and I can tell you that some of those conversations aren't that great. They're a hard starting place. So I think for us as U.S. Labor Against the War, as an organization that works at that intersection, again, we want to figure out ways, number one, to talk to those folks and find out what they want, and number two, figure out a way to help them transition away from making weapons of war and into stuff that we actually really need in the United States. Because right now, they're just kind of locked into this system. And a lot of folks don't really want to make this stuff,
mm-hmm.
But they feel trapped and feel like they don't have any other choices. So, you know, we're in that exploratory phase. We have some new ideas and some new programs, but for right now, we're really just trying to listen so that we're better able to address folks where they're at.
And I don't know if you are doing this already, but if you could speak to bringing in and involving workers within also the police and prison industry and fossil fuel industry, like extraction industry, and just how you envision or how law envisions working towards a more progressive and just and peaceful society with, you know, organizing with people who are kind of, like you said before, a part of this, sort of locked into this system.
Sure. I used to work with police deputies in Nashville, Tennessee, years and years ago. And it was not a... it was not a unit that I was part of the representation for, but I was in the same local with everybody else, and I had to, buddy up with other folks that were handling those units. And one of the things that I learned was that people are really desperate to be seen as something outside of their jobs in the United States. And originally, I thought that was a dodge. As a younger black man, I had really negative interactions with the police, so it was often really terrifying to be in those spaces with folks.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I started to understand that, my terror and my feelings were definitely justifiable, but the reality was that in my job as an organizer, I had to find the human being, and I had to reach the human being. With all that I had, and I had to make sure that as I was doing that I understood what my role was as an organizer, and that's to actually help people get to the place that they want to go. And more often than not, when I was working there and also within this job, what I found in each of the situations that you outlined, police and prison, war and fossil fuel industries, it's pretty much all the same. Folks don't want to lose their livelihood because people are dependent upon them, but people don't necessarily want to do any of the things that you described. They don't necessarily want to be working for the oil and gas industry. Mm-hmm. They don't want to make weapons of war. They don't want to necessarily be in a prison. The only thing that I see right now that's really much more complicated is the relationship the United States has with the police.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the real challenges is that we've removed police so far from society, both, with our need to feel safe as folks who are threatened by the police in marginalized communities, as well as everything from the politics to the nature of police departments themselves to separate themselves from communities, invoking the mantra of public safety, that we're in a place where it almost feels too far gone a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we've been doing within U.S. Labor Against the War these past couple of years is really linking up with folks in the Movement for Black Lives and trying to think about how do we integrate these different things together, because the reality is that we also have workers in TWA who are part of our organization, and many of them are deputized. So we have opportunities in our organization to make some space for folks to talk to each other about collective liberation and what that can look like.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very slow process. It's much slower than we'd like, and it's much slower than I'm sure folks at the table would like. But I think we've done a lot and we can do more. I think it's just a question of where the rest of American society is going to be. I really feel like there's a turning point that's happening right now in the United States. More people are talking about abolition than ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a chance. It's just a question of what kind of organizing are we going to do.
And two, I wonder if there was a shift in accountability, because like you were saying, police have become so far removed from the rest of us in society,
right,
and the lack of accountability. And, who pays for their mistakes but taxpayers? There's no direct consequence. So, perhaps in a world where they're more a part of our society and kind of held accountable in an equal way? Could something like that shift?
All right. Well, hey, we only have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I wanted to quickly at least touch on a couple things around our public schools. How do you see? Do you have any thoughts on teachers' unions playing a role in changing the ways that our public schools sort of segregates our kids, sending some off to prison, some join the professional class, and then most of them become good workers or soldiers?
Yeah. So I think for one thing, I know a lot of radical teachers and librarians in my family have talked to me about the idea of following the tradition of abolitionists and finding as many ways as you possibly can to teach what you know about even, you know, history of organizing, but also organizing itself, to students as often as you possibly can. And making it the kind of thing, you know, I know a lot of the folks in that profession in particular, right, that it's such a struggle to find the time. But I think that using educational opportunities to provide some glimpses at freedom or stoking some curiosity, having that extra conversation makes all the difference. It definitely made one for me growing up. So that's one thing. And then, of course, the other thing is, you know, young people often need a kind of quasi permission for us to go out and like make a little bit of trouble. And, you know, we should definitely encourage folks to be smart. But, you know, I think more often than not, especially right now, and I mean this in a kind way, but I definitely appreciated my professors when I was in college and the folks I've met with in high school who said, it's good to be smart, but don't ever play it safe. And I think that that kind of encouragement for younger people goes a long way.
Yeah, great. Well, in our last couple minutes, I wanted to say that I work at a high school where the JROTC program, what's that stand for? Officer training program, basically, is huge, and it serves a large number of our poor students, of course. The two instructors are members of our union. Any ideas on how our union adopts an anti-war agenda, given that reality?
So I think there's a couple of things I recommend. One, the strongest relationship we have in U.S. labor against the war right now is the one that we have with About Face, formerly AVAC Veterans Against the War. So I would say reach out to vet folks because they know how to speak the language, and they know how to define it in terms that would reach somebody like them. And they have a lot of real-world experiences in addition to resources and tools that can make it work. So align with some vets who know what's up, and that's good. I think it also gives a lot of weight when you're talking to other union folks to have somebody who's representative. The next thing I'd say is folks talk a lot about the resolutions that U.S. Labor Against the War passed in, I think it was 2005 at the AFL convention. But what folks often don't talk about is the fact that there was a lot of peer-to-peer organizing, right? Union officer speaking to union officer, working those connections, finding the tree, the phone tree that was necessary to make it all happen, and constructing that. Those kinds of organizing skills make a lot of sense. And then when you're looking to pass that resolution, you're prepared. It's not just about filing something. It's not just about having something written down, but about doing that peer-to-peer work.
Gotcha.
Because you got to outnumber them, right?
Yes.
You got to make sure that there's more of you than there are of them.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Reese, for joining us on KBOO tonight. It was a really great discussion. I really appreciate it. We both do.
Yes.
And thanks to our engineer. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Mulugeta Sarah Commemorative Conference Tuesday, November 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center in Portland. This half-day conference honors Mulugeta Sarah, 28-year-old Ethiopian college student living in Portland who was murdered by racist skinheads on November 13th, 1988. This conference will include panel discussions, continuing legal education for attorneys, and community training on addressing hate. Again, that's the Mulugeta Sarah Commemorative Conference, Tuesday, November 13th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center, 310 Southwest Lincoln Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad.
Welcome to Prison Pipeline. I'm Karen James. In October, the Uhuru Sasa Culture Club